All right, we are in CLR World again with Vance Morrison.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very good.
Excellent. So last time we talked was the CLR 4.0 time frame.
That's right.
And now we're going to see you. I guess it's been about a year and a half or
it's
so.
Been a while, yeah.
So what are you working on? What's your story these days?
So I'm working on the same thing I have been working on for quite a while, which is the performance of .NET programs. And that really splits into two different areas. One is just to make sure that the runtime itself is fast and lean, and the other one is to make sure that people are using it well. Mm-hmm. So it's more and more. It's really the case that we've squeezed all the perf, or you know, we get like 10% here, 5% here. You know, those are big wins for us. Mm-hmm. And whereas if you tell somebody how to use the runtime better, you can actually get like 10x wins or things like that. So we've been shifting gears a little bit to we've always been doing that, but we're emphasizing it more and more because more and more the performance of an application is really in the hands of the .NET developer, not us.
Sure.
So for us, we've been so to deal with the runtime part, and to make that fast, for us this time around, it's about making Windows 8 great, and that breaks into two parts for us. One is to make sure that the Windows runtime, so you can build Windows runtime objects in .NET, and you can also consume them from .NET. And so you're going to be, and as we know, Windows runtime objects are native or can be native. They can also be implemented in .NET, but we kind of expect many of them to be native. And so we want to make sure that the interoperation between .NET and these Windows runtime objects is good, fast, and lean. And so we've been spending a chunk of time making sure that that's true.
Sure. Can we just talk quickly?
Sure.
That's an excellent thing that we really haven't covered very much.
Yep.
In some sense, so WinRT provides a common type system.
Okay.
Right? And then you guys have to do some magic in the CLR. Now, is that also a performance constraint for you?
They draw these architectural diagrams, you know, and I guess I've been around WinRT too much. To me, WinRT, a WinRT object is, from a runtime perspective, a WinRT object is really not very different than a COM object. And if you look at the basics of WinRT, it is in fact COM. You have a vtable and a dispatch, and they got rid of some of the GUIDs, which is nice, but not everywhere. So they're trying to make COM nicer. But from our point of view, it's just a COM object. So in fact, when we talk to WinRT objects, we use our runtime callable wrappers and COM callable wrappers are the internal things that we use in order to talk to WinRT objects. So in that sense, we don't treat them any different than our COM interop that we used to do, or still do.
Sure.
So what WinRT is about, and so in some sense, you could argue that what we're doing is we're just making sure that COM interop became much, much more important. Before, you know, you tended to use COM interop on the boundaries of your application, and it wasn't really the heart of it. Now it might be, right? If you're using lots and lots of Jupyter objects, or you know, Windows,
XAML.
If you use XAML objects, then you might be chatting quite a bit, and so we want to make that overhead as low as we can.
Sure.
So we spent a bunch of time making that quite a bit leaner than it was.
Okay, so. And I guess by the type system I was just talking about, in some sense, you guys have string.
That's right.
I have H string.
That's right.
So, we should all say we, not they, and it's all one.
And it's true. The other issue is that, so for us, most WinRT objects are just interfaces of, down here you might have, let's not take string, but let's take... We have I enumerable, and down below we have I iterable. So you have an I iterable. You have an iterable. I think you've got that. And up here we have an ienumerable. And in fact, there's magic here. Normally, what you would have is that you would have created over here, let's assume your own, let's assume somebody in C++ has made a WinRT object called the iFoo object. He would have created a WinMD file, and we would have seen it just as iFoo, and we would have talked to it directly. And so our concept of a list, just something you can keep walking down saying next, is ienumerable. Windows came up with a thing that's very similar to it, and they called it iterable, and it wasn't exactly the same.
Okay.
And because of that, we actually had to we have to sort of do some extra magic to sort of make those the same again. But normally, what you have is somebody implemented something in Windows runtime, and we just sort of see it. That's the goal.
Cool.
Okay, so that's Windows runtime objects and sort of communication with those. Mm. We also spent some time on ARM. So the runtime is in the situation where it's always generating code. So most of the time, you port to ARM, you think, well, recompile, you might have to fiddle with the pointer sizes maybe, but hopefully most of your code would just port. For the runtime, because we're in the code generation business, we have a whole compiler to build. And then we're also in the business of making these little thunks, or we call them stubs, that sort of, deal with the fact that code doesn't exist initially, and then later it will be created just in time. So we spend a lot of time doing raw native instructions. And so we ended up spending a bunch of time porting the runtime to the ARM processor. And so that took a little while. And then after that, there was performance. So once you get it, working, now you want to make it work fast. Mm. And so we spent some more time doing that. So that's something else that's been keeping us busy.
Sure.
So that's pretty much what we did to deal with runtime performance inside. At a broad level, we've been working on Windows 8. And we've done a little bit for cloud. We're probably going to do more with cloud in the near future. But it turned out that our service story was in pretty good shape. Like, we were pretty happy. Our customers were pretty happy. Mm-hmm. And so we could concentrate on Windows 8.
Excellent.
So that was the one half of what I've personally been involved with. And then the other half of it is to make .NET programmers successful. So one thing is to make the runtime fast. Another thing is to make other people's code fast.
Yes.
And so that's really about making perf easy. Mm. And one of the best ways that you can make perf easy is to just have a good tool. If you have a good tool, good tools make things easy. One of the biggest holes in our perf story for people external to Microsoft is that we do not have a very good memory diagnostic tool. So if you are trying to track down why your GC heap is 100 megabytes when you think it should only be 30, there aren't good tools that we sell that do that. And we need to fix that. And there's broad general agreement that we need to fix it. In fact, we have something that we might release fairly soon to help fix it, and so we've been working on memory tools. As with always within Microsoft, is that we can't promise any date, certainly not on Channel 9.
Sure. Thank you.
But
I like this job. Cool.
But we are working on memory tools.
Great.
The other thing that we're working on is that when we move to Windows 8, we not only do we have to move the runtime over to Windows, when we move the ARM, the runtime over to ARM, but we also have to move all of our diagnostic tools over to ARM. In particular, profilers tend to do all sorts of instruction level magic too. So they're kind of a pain to transfer over to a new platform. And it turns out that historically, we've taken a different tack than Windows. Windows has its own profiling infrastructure called Event Tracing for Windows. And we don't use it. And part of the reason was is because 10 years ago, it wasn't very good. But it has been slowly getting better, and so that now it's pretty. It's actually very good, and it's now at the point where you could say, well, because we care about Windows, you know, because ARM is running Windows 8, it has the best version of ETW on it, and it's pretty good. So we have the choice: do we like port our stuff, or do we just use theirs? And it's easier to just use theirs. And so that's, in fact, what we're doing. We're also ETW does more than what we traditionally did. So if you look at Visual Studio, it has a it has CPU profiling. You can find out where your CPU time is being spent. And it has some other things that it can do. But that pretty much it's just CPU profiling. On the other hand, ETW, because it was built into the operating system, they'll take care of page faults, disk I.O., file I.O., context switches, which is really cool because now you can figure out, you know, when you blocked on a network call, when you blocked on a critical section, when you blocked on an event. So it's anyone who's developed, certainly for distributed applications, it's fairly common not that your application isn't CPU bound, but it's taking a long time. And you want to know, what is it doing, you know? And you can even see in the task manager, it's not consuming CPU, but it's not also making forward progress. What is it doing? Yeah. And it turns out that because of all these events plumbed into the operating system, ETW will tell you that. And so by moving over to this infrastructure, we can provide a much richer profiling experience. And so this is our opportunity to sort of make us, you know, sort of take that plunge. And then we can build and on that infrastructure and bring its value to all of our customers, which is very cool.
Awesome.
So we've been working on that. And, in fact, you might see some of that in these tools that we'll release as part of the memory tools. And then coupled with that is that not only do we have different kinds of information, you know, like the context switches and the file I.O. and the registries and all these other events that you can get at, you can also provide your own. And in fact, this next version that has been pre-released as part of the build
developer preview,
provides a new class called Event Source. And an Event Source is a new class in the runtime, the .NET runtime, which allows you to generate ETW events. So not only can you turn on the context switches and the CPU events and all those events, but you can also say, you know, I'm starting this operation here and I'm stopping it here, and thus you can bracket how much each phase of your program costs, and it's most valuable actually for the cloud because it's for GUI applications and client applications. You're sitting there in front of it. You can sort of tell when it's working well and when it's not. But for cloud operations, I mean, there's just a server farm over there, and you, if you don't have some sort of instrumentation in there that tells you what's going on, then you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And so that's when these things come in really handy. And the other cool thing is that you can add arbitrary payloads to this. So you could say, I'm starting the request from this URL. And, you know, and thus you can actually, like, now get statistics about how much each different kind of request that you service in your server is costing you. You can even charge people back, I suppose. I mean, anyway, you can do cool things. So we're providing more ETW stuff, and then on top of that, we're adding better visualizations. And this, I'll just give a quick example of this, is that it, based on these memory tools that I mentioned. So the way the memory tool works is that, you know, you have your GC heap, and basically there are a bunch of roots. So there's a root, and this is like a local variable. right? Or it might be a static variable. Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And these roots point into objects. Let's assume I had the foo object. And the foo object has three fields in it, let's say, and each of them are strings. So there's a hello, and down here there's a much larger string, and so on. And the idea is that all these things live in the GC heap, and they all take up space. And so it's very natural to create this list where you have the type and its cost, which is its size. So in this case, I have the foo type. And let's assume the foo type only had three pointer size, and let's assume we're on a 32-bit processor. So let's assume that it took, so that would be 12 bytes, right, for the foo. If it only had, we're ignoring some overheads associated with objects right now. And then strings take, a word, 2 bytes for each character. So hello is, five characters. So it would be 10 bytes plus some overhead. Let's call it 16 bytes. Who knows? Like hello. So we're going to say there's a string. And, of course, there's the hello string, which took 10 bytes, and then there's these other, and then there's all these other strings, mm-hmm. and they might add up to say 500 bytes, right? And you do this for every type, and then usually you sort them so that the biggest ones are at the top because you care about the things that are wasting the most space. And you find that whenever you do this, I mean, I've done this on a lot of heaps. I can tell you with strong certainty that string is either at the top or it's like number 2. I have never seen a heap in which a heap of an actual, like, real program, that string wasn't one of the top 3. And shortly thereafter, it's almost always object array or byte array. Now, these are a little bit more variable, depends on the app. But the object array is your collection classes, all your lists, pretty much any kind of collections class at the bottom of it is an array of objects. And so that's why if you have lots of collections, then you'll have lots of object arrays. And they tend to get very big. You can make these huge arrays, these huge collections of, millions of things, in which case you'll have a very large object array in them. So what happens is that you get these heap graph or this histogram of what's in your heap, and the problem is that the ones that are at the top, the ones that you want to concentrate on, are not very interesting. I can't do anything about strings, I can't do anything about object arrays, I can't do anything about byte arrays, and so you as a programmer are sitting there going, yeah, you just told me something that wasn't very useful. And so we want to improve that, and our solution to that is that coming back to this example, I had a foo class that used 3 strings. There's a string down here, too. So I have 3 strings. And the thing about it is the way I've sorted my data is that the cost of this foo object has been split into 2. It's been split into the exclusive part of foo, and then it's been split up into all its little bits and pieces. The foo object really is the whole thing, right? It's the foo class plus everything that it points at. And you're losing that. And so what happens is that in this histogram, foo is down at the bottom, not very interesting because it seems to be small. But it's hanging on to lots of data. And because it's hanging on to lots of data, it really should be at the top. And so we've come up with a series of very simple transformations, and one of them is what I call folding. And all that means is that it says, please assign the cost of something to whoever refers to it. So what will happen is that it's sort of like inlining. Like if you know anything about how objects are represented, you know that integer is not a separate object. It's literally part of the foo object. It's part of its essence. And so integers are always attributed to whoever owns them, whoever has actually declared them. But string is not like that. String is a separate object. And what you really are saying is, I don't want to treat string as if it were a separate object. I want to treat it like integer. and I want to fold it in so this string now becomes part, you know, logically, becomes part of the foo object, and these three strings do too. So all of a sudden, this foo object, instead of being 12 bytes, is now 12 plus the sum of all the strings that it referred to, and it's probably more like 50 bytes or something like that.
Sure.
But the point is that it attributes the cost of foo more in line with your model of the cost of foo. You sort of think of foo as owning all of those things. Now, sometimes that's not true. Sometimes these strings are shared by a million other things, and it would be unfair to attribute all the costs to this one object. But a lot of times that's not true. And so we give you the ability to flip either way. See, the original prioritization made sense if strings were shared by thousands of other objects, and you really couldn't say with any certainty that the cost of this string should be borne by this object. Mm. If that's true, then probably our original histogram was as good as you can get. But that's almost never true. And so when it's almost always the other way, which is that I have sole ownership of this string, and so why not attribute the whole cost to it? So we're doing things like that too.
Excellent. And of course, that helps developers profile into what objects are holding.
So I actually have a demo that I give people, and I take a very complicated app, in this case, Visual Studio.
Good.
And I dumped it. I grabbed its GC heap, and I just looked at the default view. And well, first of all, I show them the original view, the view that you would get with profiles that exist today. Hmm. And you know, you see string and byte array at the top, and you know, it's just not that. And you see a whole bunch of things that seem to take up a lot of space, mm-hmm. but you don't think you can do anything about. They seem to be low-level infrastructure things, and you're not sure what to do with them. Mm-hmm. I did this with Visual Studio. Visual Studio is a big, complicated app. It has a complicated GC heap associated with it. And I used the default settings for this view. And what happens is that what you will find is that you'll get a new list that doesn't have string or byte array at the top. It will have things that are much more semantically meaningful. And one of those in the top 10 was a thing called XML comment node.
Hmm.
Now, XML comment node, you're sitting there going, XML comment node? I don't know if I, you know, and this is the key to performance, is that in order to find out what, the big problem you have is how much should something cost? You know, in order to optimize something, you have to know sort of, what's the smallest cost you can make? Like, how do I reduce it? How do I make it smaller? And the answer is you look for things, you look for big things, and you look for things that you'd say, I wouldn't pay money for that. I wouldn't pay memory for that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at this thing, and you look at these types, and you say, I wouldn't pay memory for an XML comment node. I'd want that comment node thrown away immediately. Mm-hmm. Get rid of it. Because by its very nature, its point was to sort of show me things that weren't semantically meaningful.
Hmm.
And so that popped. And we found, and what was interesting is that it popped in the sense that it was up in the top 10. Oh, my heavens. Hmm. We have to do something about that. And so we discussed it. And it turned out that, you know, the developers weren't, you know, they weren't being... You know, they weren't. They were being reasonably diligent. They actually knew about the fact that they were keeping comment nodes. This wasn't sort of a first order bug.
Mm.
It's just that they had this requirement that they round trip. Mm. So in other words, I read in this XML blob, and I write it back out. It has to look exactly the same, and that's why they kept all the comment nodes. And we said, ah. Oh. And so now the real perf begins, which is, all right. It feels like we are expending memory on something that has low marginal value. Its only value was to do that round tripping, and yet it's showing up high on my perf report. Can we reduce it? And we thought about it, and said, you know what? Anytime we actually have to do that round tripping, what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the file.
Hmm.
So instead of like always having it in memory, we'll go back to the file, and then we'll do that. And so we achieved the end goal, which is to be able to round trip, but also we achieved the perf goal, which is that we don't pay for things that we don't use most of the time. So the round tripping actually happens fairly rarely. It only happens when you update XML files. And we're talking about XML files like are the build files, like the MS build project files are all XML. So you don't change them very often. You'll go into Visual Studio many, many times and not change your product project file. So that's a rare case. And so this is where you start to find things. You find things that where in the in your app, you find out you're paying more than you thought you were paying. It's sort of like when you look on your credit card bill and you say, oh my God, you know, my auto debit's going for that, you know, or my wife is spending all this stuff on this, you know. That's what good perf tools do. It sort of alerts you to how much you're paying for things. And now you can budget. You can say, I shouldn't be paying for comments. I shouldn't be paying for, you know, for another classic example is editors like to read all of the data that's read in, you know, I'm reading a 100 megabyte file, I want to read in 100 megabytes of data into my memory. Well, I'm only looking at, you know, maybe 3 kilobytes on my screen. So should I be paying 100 megabytes? And if you ever try to launch something in Notepad, you will find out that Notepad does exactly this. Like you launch a 100 megabyte file in Notepad, you'll be sitting there for about 10 or 15 seconds while it's reading that 100 megabytes in. But there are other editors, which are nicer in this respect, that you can open that 100 megabyte file and comes up in, you know, a fraction of a second, you know, milliseconds, frankly, because you only need to read in the first 10 kilobytes to display what you want. So those are the kinds of things that good perf tools point out, and we've been making good strides in making that better.
Great.
So that's coming. And then there's one final thing. I don't know if do we have time or
yeah, of course we do.
Is that we want so all of these? So I said I'm working on the runtime. I'm working on tools and making perf easy. And then the last thing is guidance. So tools are great, but you need to know how to use them. And part of that you can solve by making a better tool, by making a tool that has good documentation, that has that sort of helps you out and gives you good displays and helps you see the where your performance is going. But the other one is there's no substitute for actually understanding your tools of your trade and the things you're using to build things out of and APIs and how expensive they are and so forth. And the last time we put out external guidance was almost 10 years ago.
Wow.
So we have this performance scalability doc that we put out there, and we now have a line up there on MSDN that says this is pretty old. Don't use it.
Was that what, Rico Mariani?
He was involved when it was made, but it was actually made by our user education people.
Sure.
And it's a big, thick book. If you buy it in paper, you can get it. It's completely online, but you can actually buy it as a paper, you know, as a physical book. And when it's a physical book, it's about 2.5 inches thick. So it's a lot of information. And what since that time, a lot of the guidance in there is still relevant. It's still accurate. But what's also true is it was 2 inches thick. And we felt like we can now do a better job of prioritizing. And the other thing we can do is that tools have changed a lot since then. And while that particular book didn't talk about tools, in fact, it's tried to shy away from tools because we didn't have great tools to talk about, this time around we can talk about much better tools. And so we're going to be updating that guidance so that it will take into account the last decade of change.
Excellent. Well, that's important.
Yeah. So that will be, we're hoping to have a Wikipedia entry that points at our site and sort of make it very discoverable. So if someone says .NET Perf, they're going to find this site. And then we'll tell them what we think is the best way of accomplishing various kinds of goals.
Context, right?
Yeah. So the beauty of tools is that it's hard not to write perf guidance that isn't 2 inches thick. We try, and the problem is that and even that 2-inch thick book, it's not enough. Like there's all sorts of guidance that we'd like to put in there that we sort of stayed away from because the book was already 2 inches thick, and we didn't feel like we wanted to make it thicker. But from a tool, you can take all of that 2-inch guidance, all that information that was in there, and what you can do now is that you can put it into a tool such that when it's appropriate, when you see certain functions on the stack, when you see certain things pop up in your profile, that it might bring up, hey, you might care about this little section of that 2-inch thick book.
Great.
And because of that, you can make it 5 inches thick now, but no one cares because no one reads it end to end anymore. They run the tool, and then the tool will tell you what's important for your application, mm-hmm. and that's how we're solving the scaling problem, you know, the perf scaling problem, so to speak. So we are this time around we're going to be more tool centric because it allows us to scale. But we're also going to update our guidance and just actually prioritize it a little bit. Mm-hmm. What we want is we want to have, you know, less than 10 pages of stuff that you would read sort of end to end. Like, you know, here's the outline of perf. You know, this is how you should think about perf. And here are the broad sections. And then you could skip the sections you don't care about. And then here are the basic tools that probably everyone should know about. And then we'll leave it at that. And then if you care, you'll look into those tools, and those tools might cross-link back to those web pages and find the detailed information.
Great.
So that's the plan.
Good. So. Excellent, man. Well, that sounds like you've been busy. And it's good to see that perf is still a top priority.
It is indeed. I have a job, I'll have a job for as long as I want it, I think. So I'm not worried. I'm
Excellent.
Not worried at all.
Well, it's great to come and see you again, and we'll see you next time.
Okay. Thank
Cheers. You.